Good morning. Quickly, I have no disclosures, financial disclosures. And yes, I'm going to be talking to you this morning about personalized health planning, and I'm excited for the extra 5 minutes because I get excited about this topic. I'd like to acknowledge my colleague, Dr. Kathy Huddleston-Casas, who also helped with this presentation. So quickly, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about why we think this is important, what is personalized health planning. I'll talk to you about our sample, which came from Rural Families Speak. Talk to you a little bit about our qualitative methods that we use. We will be shifting gears from the previous presentations from numbers to quotes. Talk to you about the results and what we think some of the implications are from what we found. So as you all know, I think we have an educated audience. Poverty rates in rural areas are very high. These numbers are actually from September 2010, so the most recent numbers show that 15.1% of non-metro U.S. residents are now living at or below the poverty line. That's actually up 1.4% from the previous year, and it's also higher than the national rate. Additionally, persistent poverty is primarily a rural phenomenon. Persistent poverty is defined as at least 20% of the population lives at or below the poverty line for 4 decades or more. So of all the counties that are persistent poverty, 88% of them are rural. So what we know then is in rural areas we are dealing with low-income patients. They have limited access to providers. They experience greater costs often in terms of expense to travel to a provider. The cost of care can be challenging. There's also an underlying rural culture of self-reliance. So interestingly, kind of a nice follow-up to the previous presentation, if these patients are feeling good, they don't see a need necessarily to see a provider. It's really when something happens that interferes with their daily life that then they feel the need to see a provider. So personalized health planning is something that we've been working on at Duke University, sort of emerged from Ralph Snyderman, who's the Chancellor Emeritus, going on about 10 years ago now. And the idea is that we're really shifting the focus of care. So historically, we've been very much about sort of find it and fix it, you know, reactive, so people come in because they're experiencing a health problem. Granted, we have screening and immunization criteria, et cetera, but in our sort of traditional model of come in, see a doctor for 15 minutes and leave, there's not a lot of discussion about what's your current health status, and how do we plan for your health over time, over your lifespan, so that you actually have maximum quality of life and maximum health, really. So personalized health planning involves sort of 3 core components. The first is a very overt health risk assessment and monitoring. For any of the physicians in the room, I think, the current model is, there's this sort of mental heuristic. You know, we're checking things off, not necessarily overtly doing a risk assessment with a patient. This is about having a very overt risk assessment and monitoring. It can be technologically driven. Great example is coronary heart disease. You know, we have some genomic testing that we can do. But most of the risk factors you're talking about are very easily measured, static risk factors, sex, age, but also modifiable risk factors, weight, exercise, nutrition. So that's the core, one of the core pieces of it. The second piece is patient participation and activation. So again, sort of our traditional model is, as a physician, I say, okay, Sally, you need to lose weight, get your blood pressure down, see you next year, or see you in 6 months. We're really talking here about getting patients involved and active in their health. So what does it mean that you have, high blood pressure? What does it mean that you're overweight? What is it that will get that patient involved, invested in their health? The third piece of it is development of a very overt therapeutic and wellness plan, and that happens in collaboration with the patient. So again, it's not the physician saying, you need to lose weight, you need to lower your blood pressure, here's your medication. It's, here are your risk factors, here are what we know about those risk factors, what can you do in the context of your life, your family, your community, that can help to mitigate those risk factors? And how can we track your progress over time so that we know, are we really mitigating those risk factors, or do we need to shift something in what you're doing in order to, again, maximize your health? Interestingly, with the recent passage of the healthcare reform bill, there are actually two pieces of the legislation now that are focused on exactly this process, on individualized, personalized wellness. One is through the Community Health Center Initiative. There are demonstration projects to actually include individualized wellness plans for patients. And the second is through Medicare coverage. Medicare now will cover one personalized health planning visit per patient annually, and that visit includes a health risk assessment and includes an actual, you know, tracking and plan for the patient for the ensuing year. So the purpose of our study was to really see how this might apply in a rural context. Would it be valuable? Would it be useful? Most of the models that we have, really all the models that we have at Duke, have been really in urban, you know, populations. So we took our rural families' speak data, which this study was originally designed to see how rural families were faring after welfare reform, both health-wise, financially, within their families and communities. But to take this study and to look, number one, what are the types and perceived severity of the health problems these families are facing, and then what strategies are they employing to manage these health issues, and to see how personalized health planning might be used in that context. So a little bit about our sample. Rural Families Speak is a multi-state study. The states that are in green on the map are the participating states. It was funded by the USDA, and we collected data on 413 families over 3 years. The families had to be living in counties that were rural as designated by the Rural Urban Continuum Codes between 6 and 8, meaning that they were living in communities that were as small as less than 2,500 people, all the way up to 20,000 people. And if you're unfamiliar with the coding, the reference point would be 1 would be most urban, New York City, 9 most rural, you know, Great Plains rural. So we collected these data annually between 2000 and 2002. The data that I'm going to be presenting today come from 2002 wave of data. So our sample was predominantly white, although we did have representation from African American, Latina, and other race women and their families. They had to have at least one child under the age of 13 to participate in the study, because we were looking at faring after welfare reform, and since having a child is a requirement to receive TANF, that was one of the requirements to enter the study. They were earning incomes at or below 250% of the poverty line. At the time of enrollment in the study, that worked out to about $42,600 annually for a family of four. And we recruited the families through programs serving low-income folks, so TANF, WIC, food stamps, Head Start, county extension agencies, et cetera. So we had trained interviewers who collected both qualitative and quantitative data in semi-structured interviews. So we did collect some data using standardized instruments, and then we also had interview questions. We collected all the data in face-to-face interviews, and the qualitative data were recorded on digital audio recorders and transcribed. And participants were either assigned a pseudonym or they provided one for us. We gave them the option if they wanted to select one or wanted us to do that for them. So the subsample that we're talking about today, we randomly selected 45 women from our larger sample, and we selected 15 from each insurance category. So insured with private insurance, such as an HMO, PPO, insured with public insurance, Medicaid, or uninsured. As we were going through the transcripts, one of the transcripts wasn't following the interview protocol, so we deleted that participant. So we had 44 total participants in this study, this sub-study. Just a little bit about what they look like. Their mean age was 32.7 years. Most of them were married or living with a partner, with the rest either single, divorced, or separated. As I mentioned, 61.4% were non-Hispanic white, and then the remaining were Latina, Black, or identified as another race or ethnicity. And there were no statistically significant differences between this subsample's demographics, and then the larger studies, 413 subjects, demographics. So we used an integrative secondary thematic analysis to analyze these data. We selected text fragments from the interviews that addressed anything that had to do with health. So when there were, you know, questions about health, or they actually even referenced their health in response to other questions, we selected those text fragments out. We organized those sort of initial codes into themes, and then Kathy and I worked separately and then came back together and said, okay, what did you see, what did you see, and we came to a consensus on that. We also calculated some percentages based on counts of responses, so when they reported that they had a specific health issue, we kept tallies of that and then sort of created some count data that we summarized, which I'll be showing you here. So looking at chronic conditions, almost 91% of these women reported that at least one family member had a chronic health problem. Now, the health problems that came up for adults included sort of generic heart problems, high blood pressure, digestive problems, depression, anxiety, substance use, allergies, asthma, thyroid problems, kidney problems, back problems, joint problems, chronic pain, arthritis, tobacco use, anemia, migraines, headaches. So those were the ones that came up in this sample of 44 women. As far as the children were concerned, the ones that came up were allergies, asthma, anemia, depression, anxiety, ADD or ADHD, digestive problems, and migraines and headaches. So those were the problems that came up for this subsample. And then you can see that almost 3/4 of them reported that at least two family members had a chronic condition. The median number of chronic conditions per family was 5. So basically, each family is dealing with, you know, about 5, you know, the range was somewhere between 0 and 20 chronic conditions in their families. Looking at the women respondents themselves, so 86.4% of them reported that they had one or more chronic conditions that they were dealing with. You can see 70.5% of them said that they were dealing with between 2 and 11 chronic conditions. So some of these women were really dealing with a lot of health issues. The women reported on behalf of their partners and on behalf of their children. So 45.5% of them reported that their partner also had at least one chronic condition and as many as 6. With regard to children, the interesting thing is that 1/4 of these women said that they had 2 or more children that had a chronic health problem. So, you know, we have women who are dealing with their own health, and then they're also dealing with chronic health problems among their kids. So we wanted to look at management. How are these women, you know, managing these multiple chronic health problems? And really what we saw is they're demonstrating pretty low engagement overall in their health. We sort of broke it out into 3 core themes, one of which is that in some cases just very passive about their health. They recognize there's something is wrong, but they're not really doing anything about it. Poor understanding of existing conditions, and lack of planning for future health. And for time's sake, I'm going to present just a couple of representative quotes for each of these that sort of demonstrate these themes. So Ellen of Indiana, she's privately insured, and she asks whether her health had caused her to accomplish less than she would like. She says, "Yes, my big health issue is that I'm too fat. I am just too fat, and it's so miserable. So I just sit all the time, and I don't do anything." Deborah of New Hampshire is a publicly insured woman who responded, "Have any of your health problems been resolved?" "No," she says. She says, "You just know what they are now." She says, "Yeah, well, I've always known what they were, you know. You don't need a doctor anymore unless you need medicine." And as background on this, Deborah reported in the previous year experiencing chronic pain, depression, anxiety, migraines, a learning disability, and she also had permanent disability status. So lots going on, and yet, you know, not really saying, you know, "I don't really need the doctor unless I need some medicine." Poor understanding of health. This was an interesting theme that emerged, in the sense that women would be talking about these health problems, but it was clear they were unsure what was actually going on. So in this instance, Amanda's son has cerebral palsy. And she's talking about the fact that they just found out that he has PVL, periventricular leukomalacia. Yes, there's my word, at 8, 9 in the morning. So as she's talking about it, she says, for example, the gray matter of his brain is dead. Well, PVL actually affects the white matter of the brain. The other thing she's saying is that, you'll see, she says, it affects him similar to CP, his speech, fine motor skills, walking, muscles in his legs. It can eventually get to the point where he can die from it, but because he has the CP, which we're thanking the Lord every day for that, it doesn't sound like you should, but in this case we are, because CP doesn't get worse. It counteracts the PVL. It keeps it from getting worse. Well, actually, PVL is one of the number one causes of cerebral palsy. So it's clear that she's not understanding her son's condition fully and what this means for him, his health, and really the management of his condition. Here's an interesting one. Marilyn of Louisiana is asked, has she ever used a medicine differently from how it's prescribed? And she says, no. In fact, once I start feeling better, I stop taking it. So if we're talking antibiotics here, that's a problem. So again, not having a really thorough understanding of what's this medication for, how long do I need to be taking it, is it okay to stop taking it once I feel better? That might be okay for pain medicine, but again, if it's an antibiotic for, a sinus infection, you want to finish all your doses. So again, not having great understanding necessarily of what the situation is as far as their health's concerned. Another thing we saw was lack of planning, and this I think we saw more in the publicly insured and the uninsured patients than we saw in the privately insured patients. But Nan of Maryland says, well, there were a couple of times when I had to go to the emergency room, but that was, I think it was last year before my back was just out of sorts and I couldn't get a hold of a doctor. And this is a woman who has a chronic back problem. So again, not managing that condition over time, but instead having exacerbations and ending up in the ED. Lenore of Indiana, also uninsured, is asked about getting to medical appointments. And this woman also has a number of health problems. She reported that she had depression, anxiety, alcohol use, tobacco use. She also has joint pain, arthritis pain, and anemia. So when she's asked about getting a medical appointment, she says, I don't go to the doctor. And the interviewer goes on and says, well, if you needed some kind of health care, what would you do? She says, the hospital. I can get there in 20 minutes, but normally I just go to Planned Parenthood. Well, Planned Parenthood is a great resource for women as far as reproductive health is concerned, but probably not the best resource, for example, for joint pain, arthritis, or even depression, anxiety, substance use issues. So what are the implications of this? Personalized health planning is an important tool that has the potential to improve rural health. Number one, it's a tool that can be used to engage patients in their health. So they can become active participants by being directly involved in the planning, working in partnership with the primary care provider, and being educated on their risk. So part of a risk assessment is also conveying to the patient, what is your risk? What does that mean over time? And how do we help you mitigate the risk, those risks, and have better quality of life and better health? It also helps patients to improve understanding, again, of their current and future health. So as I mentioned, increasing knowledge about risk, about their existing health conditions, and also I think increasing understanding of health as a resource. So I think, it's nice to follow the previous presentation, because I do think that this is an area for us to do work in, is how do we engage patients, rural patients in particular, to understand that health is a resource that can be managed to a degree. Even in the context of limited resources, it can be managed. And how do we engage them in that process? It also helps patients to plan for their health. So the patient is involved in all phases of planning. It helps them to provide a better understanding of trade-offs. Countless examples in our interviews about, you know, mom not going to the doctor, you know, because she had to pay for her child to go to the doctor, you know, mom not taking medicine because she had to get a child's prescription filled. So having a really good understanding of what the trade-offs are, what does it mean for you, both for your health and even your finances later, if you have an exacerbation and end up in the ED? You know, what does it mean if you don't take medicine for a week? You know, is there an alternative? You know, are there resources that we can connect you to? Do you need to call the office? Can we give you samples? So really helping patients plan for when they probably will have to make trade-offs at some point, because that's the reality of their lives. And also, plans can be reinforcing for all family members. So if somebody is trying to lose weight or manage diabetes and they're making changes in their diet, that's going to affect all of the family members. You know, if they're starting an exercise routine, maybe mom does something with her kids. It helps to reinforce positive behaviors. And then also the family has its own social network, so they can, you know, again, sort of support each other in making changes. So some of the limitations: our data are not nationally representative, they are self-reported, and we had a small sample size. Even in our larger study of 413, still a small sample size when you consider 20% of the U.S. population is rural. And our data are 7 years old. However, interestingly, HHS put out a report this summer that said that little has changed in the rural healthcare system in the last decade. So we think research should really investigate personalized health planning in rural primary care. Through the Affordable Care Act, there will be an online health risk assessment available through the CDC that anybody can use, so trying to integrate that into practice. But you can also use paper and pen planning tools. I think the main thing is getting patients involved. And also using health coaches and getting them integrated into care. We've had some success with that with cardiovascular disease and with diabetes management, and we did have some low-income patients. They weren't rural, but it can be done telephonically, and so patients don't actually have to go anywhere to do it. And some health insurance companies are actually already offering that service, so even thinking about connecting patients who do have insurance to those resources. And I mentioned funding USDA already, and just Derek Feldman and Ralph Snyderman gave some nice comments. So, thank you.